From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
For Jamal, as for too many journalists, the truth he sought to expose was inconvenient, at least for leaders trying to cover up on their abuses of power. And so the Saudi government decided to silence Jamal forever.
That's Washington Post publisher and CEO Fred Ryan in an awards ceremony last month talking about the slain Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Khashoggi was one of a small group of journalists honored this week as Time Magazine's People of the Year. Guardians, the magazine called them. I think the special issue is often a stunt. But this year's edition was a moving recognition of the perils journalists face simply for trying to do their jobs. Tossed in jail, exiled, censored, and worse. We're going to spend an hour today talking about the role of the press. And despite the instantaneous nature of digital communications, we'll talk about the success many regimes achieve in trying to stop the news from getting out and from getting out to you. It's a subject with policy implications and a beating human heart. Join us. What value do you place on a free press? And what's the American role in this global story? We have an impressive lineup of folks that are joining us this hour of journalists. But first, I'd like to start with a guest from Washington. It's Jason Rezaian. He's a columnist and former Tehran bureau chief for The Washington Post. Jason, welcome.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. You know, I know that you're not here simply to talk about your own circumstances, and you're here to stand up for Khashoggi and others and the principles that you believe in so much. But I think it's worth pointing out to people what you went through. You're an American citizen of Iranian-American descent, raised in California, as was I in the last one. But you, as a result of your reporting, were convicted of espionage in a closed-door trial, a conviction announced in October 2015, late in a prison term you served, and you were in prison for 18 months. What were the Iranian authorities trying to accomplish in doing this?
Well, that's a great question, and I think it's still a bit unclear. But I think as in so many of these cases, whether it's the imprisonment or the killing of a journalist, it's a matter of trying to silence people. And not only silence an individual, in that case me, or in the case of the murder of Jamal, it's also about silencing others and putting a chill across a wide range of people working inside and outside those countries, trying to compel them, to deter them from writing or speaking out.
Now, to be clear to people, and I know that this is sensitive stuff, that you know you weren't subject to club fed. This was not as though you had some securities violation and you went somewhere and were able to play golf 6 hours a day inside some light security prison. This was pretty rough treatment. I don't mean to press too strongly, but I'd like our listeners to have a sense of what the force of the state was like against you.
It was all-encompassing. I mean, there was a massive propaganda campaign against me, and one that that the Washington Post and others in the international media did a great job of counteracting. And again, not every journalist that's in trouble around the world has the support of such impressive institutions on their side. And it's for that reason that myself and others right now are trying to shine a light on those that are being imprisoned and attacked for doing their work, doing this work, wherever they are in the world.
Mm-hmm. And my sense is also you were subjected to an attempt to discredit you by the Iranians. You were also subject to fairly intense psychological and physical pressure as well. I mean, I don't want to gloss over too lightly about this.
Again, I mean, this is something that yes, I was, and so many other people are going through this. I want to keep the focus on what people are enduring right now, because this is not a problem that was imposed on me and stopped with me.
It didn't start with me either. Right.
You know, I'd like to spend our time talking about people that are suffering this fate today, and what we can do about stopping it moving forward. If there's something that we can do to stop it moving forward.
Fair enough. And I want to draw on this in some ways, or I wanted to do that because I think there are ways in which the immediate can illuminate the universal in some ways.
Right.
We also are having some strong interest from listeners. I do want to go to a couple of calls quickly. Edmund is calling from Mississauga, Ontario. Edmund, thanks for joining us. What's your question?
Yeah, thanks for the conversation, David. My question is this. Since since roughly 95% of journalists are self-described liberals, isn't it a good thing that they're being killed?
Okay, I'm going to stop that right now, and I want to be clear to people that whatever you think of the press, and I say this as a media reporter, as a journalist, and as a human being, because without a partisan approach, one can say we're human beings here. The idea of advocating harm against people who are, by all intents and purposes, trying to bring information to light is not what we're going to use this show to ever do, and I want to underscore that. I have with us in studio here as well the head of a group called the Committee to Protect Journalists, CPJ it's called. It compiles all kinds of reports and lists and data, and I draw on it in my reporting. We're happy to draw on your expertise. But Joel, why is a committee with this mandate and this name even necessary?
Because journalists around the world are vulnerable to violence and repression, and we depend on those journalists to keep us informed about global events. I think just as Jason was describing his own experience reporting from Iran, he was imprisoned there. But many journalists have been imprisoned in Iran, and most of them are Iranian. I think that's a point that Jason would want me to make. And one of the things CPJ is known for, we're an organization of journalists, and we've been around for almost four decades. And we use the tools of journalism to defend the rights of our colleagues around the world and ensure that they're able to report the news without fear of reprisal, because, frankly, we depend on them. And one of the things that we're known for is our data. David, as you mentioned, and we have a new report out just yesterday about journalists imprisoned around the world. Mm-hmm. And for the third year in a row, it's over 250. It's near record numbers, and this is becoming the new normal. Hundreds of journalists imprisoned around the world. The leading jailers of journalists are in Turkey, in China, and in Egypt, where there's a major ongoing crackdown underway. Saudi Arabia. There's been a big crackdown and an escalation in repression there. So these crackdowns are actually impeding our ability, people in this country and all over the world, to stay informed. Because when murder and imprisonment are a highly effective form of censorship. And so this affects all of us, and that's why we have to stand up for the rights of journalists and ensure that they're able to do their work.
We have a call, I think, along these lines from East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Sam, go ahead.
Hey there. I've got two brief points here, two mm-hmm. on points, if you will.
Sure.
First of all, in a world when we are all rightfully saying thank you for your service to folks who join the military and go fight our battles overseas, many of which are wars of choice and perhaps not well advised. In any case, we thank them for their service. They're armed. They have guns. They have lots of ammunition. The media, meanwhile, the press, the news gatherers go out to the most dangerous spots in the world and domestically. And there they are with maybe a flak jacket, a microphone, and a camera. And they are there trying to bring the truth back to us. It's time for thank you for your service to all news gatherers. That's point one. Point two, Donald Trump, whatever you think of him, and I can find maybe 5% of what Donald Trump says and does that I can agree with. But if he had done nothing else that offends you, his attack on the First Amendment, the First Amendment, not the Second, not any of the other, the First Amendment, his attack mm-hmm. on the First Amendment and on the people who exercise that critical element of our society and our politics is reprehensible and contemptible. And it's just sad that the media is in a position where they feel that they can't blow their own horn too much or fight back directly, but I wish they would, and I wish the populace... That guy from Canada,
That was scary stuff. And Sam, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. We'll turn a little bit later in the show to the question of what's happening here on the home front and President Trump. But Jason Rezaian, you know, if you were to be talking to news organizations, what seems to be effective to try to either ensure people don't get this kind of retribution against them by foreign governments, thrown in jail, exiled, or to aid them if they should face such measures?
Well, I think we're living in a moment that your caller alluded to, where I wouldn't say that we deserve a pat on the back or thanks for what we do, but I do think that it's important that we're acknowledged as human beings doing a job. And unfortunately, many governments around the world have taken to really discrediting our very humanity in the ways that they target us, in the ways that they talk about us, and increasingly in the ways that they track people down and kill us. And I think that it starts at the top. And unfortunately, the president that we have here in the United States at the moment hasn't been fulfilling that traditional role of protecting and advocating for free expression around the world. And I think, unfortunately, the words that he has had for the press have been an indicator, a signal to some of the worst actors. And Joel can talk more to those numbers to be more repressive, that they can get away with this. And I don't think that there's an effective tool right now. We haven't developed an effective tool to counteract it yet.
Joel Simon, we only have a little bit of time, but remind us of the kinds of things you measure. You measure imprisonments, deaths, what else?
Yeah, so the data includes journalists who are in prison around the world, journalists who are killed, and we do daily alerts about attacks on journalists anywhere in the world. We document those attacks. We produce detailed reports. We send delegations to meet with governments and protest these conditions. We mobilize the media on behalf of press freedom. So basically, our work is a kind of name and shame strategy. It's using the tools of journalism, documentation and reporting to defend the rights of journalists all over the world.
So a combination of Fourth Estate and flare gun, I guess,
if you will. There you go.
So we're talking about the growing threats of harassment, violence, prison, and even at times death for journalists as conflict and authoritarianism rise around the world. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about journalists around the world, how they're being harassed, jailed, even killed in significant and greater numbers as democracies struggle and political conflict and authoritarianism advance around the world. You can join the conversation. What importance do you place on the safety of journalists and their reporting? With us from Washington is Jason Rezaian. He's a columnist and former Tehran bureau chief for The Washington Post. And he has a book coming out next month called Prisoner, My 544 Days in an Iranian Prison, Solitary Confinement, a Sham Trial, High Stakes Diplomacy, and the Extraordinary Efforts It Took to Get Me Out. Also with me here in studio in New York is Joel Simon. He's executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. And he's the author of We Want to Negotiate, The Secret World of Kidnapping, Hostages, and Ransom, to be published next month. Think how ominous it is for that to be a subject closely allied to journalism. And also joining us now here in New York City is Janine DiGiovanni, a longtime war correspondent. She's currently a senior fellow at Yale University and author of the new book, The Morning They Came for Us, Dispatches from Syria, in which she recounts the experiences of women war correspondents, including herself and Marie Colvin, a renowned reporter about whom a film just made its debut. I wanted to start, you know, over the course of this hour, we're trying to highlight various journalists who've been in sort of perilous circumstances. In September, after the Reuters journalists Hua Lone and Cha Soo-woo were sentenced to 7 years in prison for their reporting in Myanmar, a UN panel called for their release. During that discussion, the editor-in-chief of Reuters, Stephen Adler, and the human rights attorney Amal Clooney made a rallying cry for journalists around the world.
There comes a time when you can't really be quiet anymore and people should be speaking out.
The mistreatment of Hua Lone and Cha Soo-woo is not just about these two reporters or about Reuters or even about Myanmar. The attack on them is a chilling warning to other journalists worldwide.
In their case, they were reporting on the deaths of 10 Rohingya, an ethnic minority in Myanmar, and people who have been subject to both being forced out of the country and at times mass killings. Janine DiGiovanni, what do you see in what's happening there that applies to what's happened in other places?
Well, David, it's good to see you. I've been working as a war reporter for 30 years, and the changes that have occurred from the direct attacks on reporters, which is happening now. Back in the days of the war in Bosnia, Sarajevo, if you were injured, if you were killed, it was usually because you were too close to a mortar or too close to a bomb, you were sniped. But it wasn't so targeted. Mm-hmm. And I think the difference now, if you're going to report on something in a closed country, let's say Syria, Russia, Iran, North Korea, If they're not letting journalists in, we pretty much know that there's something going on there, that we need to be reporting, that we need to be there. I work alone. I don't have a crew with me. I don't have security. I don't have armed guys. And in the past, it would usually be that I'd go somewhere, walk over a mountain or somehow get into the country. And I would work with a local journalist and try to uncover what was going on. Now that is increasingly dangerous as we're being targeted, as we're being identified as human rights reporters or as reporters that regimes do not like. We're being threatened. And I think what it means is the quality of reporting that's coming out has changed drastically.
I think you talked about having to do some reporting. You were exiled from Syria at one point. You had to do reporting from outside Syria. And I know that my colleague Deb Amos, who I think is very able and wonderful, has been in, but also has had to do that as well.
There's Syria, for instance. Either you get a visa from the regime, and which I had several, but if you do something they don't like, in my case, I reported a massacre, they throw you out and they will not give you a visa again. The only journalists that get visas to go to Damascus or the regime side now are people who are friendly to the regime. So then we would cross through the opposition side, which mm-hmm. was illegal and became increasingly dangerous as the Islamic State took more and more checkpoints and areas. And that meant the kidnapping was more prevalent. So more reporters who were just going to do their job were targeted not just by the regimes themselves, but then by violent non-state actors. So it was a no-win situation. I did both sides, the Damascus, the opposition side. I also worked around in refugee camps. Sometimes what reporters can do is you can get testimonies from refugees and then try to back them up with evidence, forensic evidence inside the country, mass graves or concentration camps or torture. But it's interesting because the whole thing about silencing us, I've never felt in 30 years more when it's been a more important time to be a reporter. Mm-hmm. I often felt as the years went by that we were overlooked or we were underpaid or but now I feel so proud of what we do because I feel like we've never been more needed to tell the truth and to shine a light. You know, it's a cliche thing that we always say, but to bear witness or to shine a light in a dark corner. If they're trying to keep us out, if they're trying to stop us, that means that there's something they're trying to hide. And it's just in our nature to try to find out what that is.
Jason Rezaian, you know, you're here not only to talk about your experience, as you said, but also that of Jamal Khashoggi, your late Washington Post colleague, and others. How well do we understand, as a result of crackdowns in Iran and Saudi Arabia, what's happening inside those countries, you know, consequential things that would give us an understanding of what those countries are actually doing?
Well, I think that, the understanding of both of those countries is so limited. And unfortunately, that's by design, as Janine pointed out. I mean, these governments don't want people coming there to report what's actually happening inside their borders. But in both cases, you have very large and flourishing social media communities putting out lots of information about what's going on in daily life. I mean, there's a lot of protests going on in Iran right now. In Saudi Arabia, there's protests as well, and there's some changes in the rules governing the society. But unfortunately, without journalists and trusted journalists and ones who are able to communicate on through platforms that are well known and well vetted, it's hard to really know what's going on. It's hard to know what those protests in Iran are actually trying to achieve. And I think Janine made a great point. Our work has never been more important than it is right now. But in some ways, I feel like it's never been less effective, and that's very very sad.
Joel Simon, you think about these issues in a broad sense every day. You heard Jason Rezaian say a bit earlier that essentially it's not only his imprisonment was not only to prevent him from getting reporting out and to imprison him, but it was to chill. It was to send a message. It was to send a warning. How effective have these warnings been?
I think they're very effective. I mean, I think in a place like Iran, the systematic efforts by the government to use a threat of imprisonment, it certainly deterred Iranian journalists, and it's deterred the international media as well. A lot of the journalists who've been in prison are Iranian American, like Jason, and they're a special target of the government. But I think
the idea that somehow they're betraying their
I think the Iranian government feels that they're subject to Iranian law, mm-hmm. and so they and they're also able to access the country in ways that people who don't have don't have an Iranian heritage are not. But the I think the broader point is it's a much more complex environment. As Janine was indicating, as Jason was indicated, there's a vibrant presence of social media. People are using new strategies and new techniques. And I agree with Janine that journalism has never been more important. But I disagree with Jason in the sense that I feel that there is a growing awareness. And I see it because of the nature of my work and the attention we're getting, the response to the Khashoggi murder, the outcry. I think that the Time magazine recognition of these guardians. And I think there's an awareness in this country because of the kind of rhetoric that the president is using and the way in which journalists are doubling down and doing their job in reporting of precisely what's at stake. So I feel that maybe we're at a pivotal moment, a kind of recalibration of power, the kinds of recalibration maybe we saw during the Watergate era. So I am not as pessimistic as Jason, but I do. I in some ways, I feel energized and revitalized by this moment that we're living through right now.
If I could add something,
yeah, Jason, please.
Joel, I appreciate your optimism. I'm generally a very optimistic person. I worry that we're up against such strong forces, and I agree with you. I mean, there's a new interest and care for what we do, but there's also massive resources being put forward by authoritarian regimes and governments that are moving in that direction to shut us up. While the mountain is high, I agree with you. It's not insurmountable.
We have a clip of remarks made by a senior correspondent for The New York Times. His name is Mujib Mashal. There was an incident earlier this year in May in which 10 journalists were killed in a single day in Afghanistan. And he talked about his personal pain and the recognition of what had just occurred in this clip.
To think about the hundreds and thousands of photos just like that, of somebody killed in the brutal violence that he had taken, and then to realize that one day he ends up like that, he ends up on the front page of a paper, it it does break my heart.
Mujib Mashal there talking about a photojournalist who was killed in the kind of incident he chronicled himself. Janine DiGiovanni, one of the things that he said was it was his belief that it wasn't just that the journalist was killed in that incident, but that they were targeted. And I think you were alluding to that a bit earlier. That is the sense that these are not incidental, accidental costs of covering war, but this is, you know, you remember in the 80s, everybody had Prensa, you know, in Civil American Wars on their chest. It meant they wouldn't be shot at in Lebanon. You thought of this. But now actually it's just saying you're more of a target than ever.
No, absolutely. I remember there was one point of the Bosnian War when the Croats put 50 Deutschmarks on the head of every journalist, and we were also insulted. But that was the first time that there was a real indication that we're going to go after these people because we don't want them to tell the story of what's happening. But now it's much more systematic. It's about drawing up lists of certain journalists who, for instance, report human rights that will never be allowed into. I mean, I'm banned from Russia, Syria, and Iran. That's three countries I can't go into. In the old days, I would have tried to enter illegally anyway, because I would have waged the risks and thought, okay, I'm going to go in. I'm going to find out what it is they're trying to keep from me. Now, you will be killed. You will be put in jail. I mean, I was told very emphatically by the Russians that if I ever came back, I would go the way of Anna Politskaya, the Russian journalist who reported from Chechnya, who was assassinated by Putin's men. Marie Colvin, who the Sunday Times reporter, American, was killed in Homs in 2012. You know, whether or not she was actually targeted or whether she was in harm's way is now being disputed. But it's for certain that the regime did not want her there, the Syrian regime, and that she was crossing over illegally. So I think the issue we're dealing with now is that we're very unprotected. And without people like Joel, like CPJ, we'd be completely vulnerable. And so I think the way that we work has to be rethought. And that's why we're relying more and more now on national journalists, on local journalists, what we used to call our fixers. And I think that's almost an insulting term.
It's kind of dismissive, right?
It is. And they're not. They're now, I mean, the people that I would go to Chechnya or East Timor or the Congo, and I'd find a local reporter and I'd work alongside them. They're now the people who are the real heroes, the real unsung heroes that we need to focus on and help and support as much as we can.
I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Joel Simon, what works when you go to talk to some ambassador or some deputy minister somewhere? What seems to get purchased to say, look, we need to have some understanding that journalists can do their jobs?
Well, right now, I have to concede it's a very difficult environment because the tools that we have that are most effective are, one, the kinds of responses that we saw in the Khashoggi killing, where there's an international media outcry. The media itself covers these incidents and gives them visibility. That has a big difference. You know what's missing right now is pressure from the U.S. government. That's actually been critical. Certainly the U.S., we know, does not have a perfect press freedom record. But in the international arena, under Democrats and Republicans, it has advocated for the rights of journalists and defended the rights of journalists to report the news. And that's if you have a poor press freedom record or you're indifferent to the murder of journalists, you would have faced some pressure from the United States, at least at the level of the ambassador. And that's really gone. I mean, not only is the U.S. not applying that pressure, but it doesn't have much credibility when it does.
In normal circumstances, Mike Pompeo would be doing this. The U.N. ambassador would be doing
this. Mike Pompeo or the U.S. ambassador or the ambassador of the country, or it might come onto the bilateral agenda during the meeting. Janine was just talking about Anna Politkovskaya and her murder back in Russia in 2006. Well, President Bush got on the phone to President Putin and said that, I think this murder is really harmful to Russia and Russia's international image. Can't imagine President Trump having that conversation.
You know, for some of the public, we don't have a ton of time for the end of this segment, but for some of the public, they may hear, well, there was a readout and the president rebuked a prime minister or another president and says, well, you know, these are just – It's actually meaningful when they do
that.
Oh,
yeah, it's meaningful because it works its way down through the bureaucracy. It affects the relationship at every level. I'm not saying there isn't a lot of cynicism in these kinds of relationships. You know, they're trying. Sometimes they're just trying to see what they can get away with. There are, you know, they're in the foreign policy debate in the United States. There are strategic relationships that often trump these kinds of concerns. But they're part of the agenda. They're part of the discussion. That's missing. That's gone.
Jason Rezaian, I'm going to give you the last word for this segment of the show. You said that you're usually a hopeful guy. 30 seconds. What gives you some signs of hope? I think we lost Jason, and I don't think that should be taken as a vote against hope.
I can say something.
Pop in there,
I think
Janine
we just
Devine.
Do our job. We have to do our job. I mean, we just put our heads down and we just have to keep one foot in front of the other and do what we always do. Nothing's going to stop us now. And especially the more that our president disrespects us, the more that we're seen as a kind of evil force, the more we're going to go out there and keep doing our work. We're not going away.
That voice belongs to Janine DiGiovanni. She's an author, a longtime foreign correspondent, a human rights reporter. We also have with us in studio here Joel Simon. He's the head of the Committee to Protect Journalists. We're proud and happy to have him. Both of you, please stick around. We want our listeners to stick around. We've also benefited much from the words of Jason Rezaian, who's both an advocate for press liberties and also a distinguished journalist who himself served time in an Iranian jail. You can join our conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik.
We are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake. A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people.
That's President Trump speaking early last year in Maryland, making one of his many critiques of the press. There are those who say that those critiques have an effect beyond America's border. Maria Ressa heads the independent Philippines news service called Rappler. It's been under multiple legal threats and attacks from the government of President Duterte in the Philippines. Last month, she won various awards in recognition of her crusading and brave work. Here, Ressa notes how President Trump and Duterte seem to be encouraging one another to attack the press.
Our problems are fast becoming your problems. Boundaries around the world have collapsed, and we can begin to see a kind of global playbook. When President Trump banned Jim Acosta last night, he followed President Duterte's actions against our reporter, Pia Ranada, and me. I haven't reported, but I'm banned from the palace for early this year. Of course, when Trump called CNN and the New York Times fake news a week later, you saw the video, Duterte called Rappler fake news.
Fake news. Joel Simon, how damaging is what the president has to say locally to the stature of journalists abroad as well?
Tremendously damaging. He's empowering autocrats and dictators around the world. Fake news has become the preferred framework for repression that governments around the world, and some repressive governments and some not repressive governments, use to justify cracking down on the media, discrediting, undermining the media. Let me give you a data point on this. One of the things I mentioned, CPJ has been tracking journalists imprisoned around the world. One of the categories of charges we've documented for a long time is what we call false news, same as fake news. And the number of journalists imprisoned around the world on those charges before President Trump took office was 9. And in our latest census, it's 28. So, and one country, Egypt, has really taken advantage of this new framework, and they're using it to justify and imprison journalists in that country.
And don't look now, Russia. We're trying to catch up, right? You know, it's like,
it's an absolute gift, and it also, going back to my other point about the ability of the United States to exert a positive influence in terms of pressuring governments that are repressive, when the president of the United States talks about the media in this way, it undermines the influence that we are able to bring to bear. So it's a very destructive framework. I think journalists in this country don't like it, but they can go about their reporting. But in other parts of the world, that framework is translated into actual repression.
Following on from what Joel is saying, one thing that really frightens me is that the fake news, one of the fallouts of it, is that it causes disinformation and confusion amongst the general public. So I'll give you an example which is international, but I think the same thing is going on domestically with President Trump. After a chemical attack in Syria, Khan Shakun, the Russian disinformation was so great that they managed to influence people with social media to believe that it never actually happened, that there was no chemical attack, that the evidence that we had, the photographs, the testimonies were all made up. And they did it in such a convincing way that intelligent people would say to me, but, you know, that attack was made up. That was fake, wasn't it? And what I realized with America watching all of the Fox News or the polarized news channels right now, people in who are not journalists, we're reporters. We read everything. We read, you know, we look at it from every angle. But let's say my mother or my relatives or my friends in the Midwest, they're not following it as closely as we are. And the amount of confusion that they're getting about what is happening is, I think, spun very carefully by Trump and his – it's a strategic communications ploy to really bring less information to the public. And I think that reminds me historically of things that happened in Europe in the 1930s with the rise of fascism.
Well, that's a pretty strong comparison.
Yeah, but that's – I mean, I'm beginning to see the authoritarian leaders around the world in Europe – in the Middle East, there is a kind of united front against democracy. And of course, one of the leading pillars of democracy is freedom of the press and human rights, of course.
We've got a couple of calls on these and related topics that are rolling in from all over the country. I'd like to take a call now from Omaha, Nebraska. Elaine, tell me about what role you think the press plays.
Well, first, thanks, David, for this crucial topic. I think the free press is one of the most important to states. It's absolutely necessary for democracy and a republic, as indicated by the fact that it's in the First Amendment. So it must be protected. And I think, you know, whenever a president demeans it and degrades it and maligns it in a very generic way, you know, that everybody who tells the truth is lying, then we have to, you know, really expose him. And I think the press is doing a pretty good job. Not making up things about him, but just reporting what he has said and done. So I really appreciate your work.
Well, thank you so much, Elaine, for that call. We'd also like to take a call from Elk Point, South Dakota. Jade, tell me what you think this is about.
Hi, Todd. First, I want to thank you for the article you wrote up, Mr. Farrell, the other day, David. Thanks.
Oh, that thanks. Was my day job. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can tell you that I've been a long-term small-town journalist, and even in my town, sometimes if you say something a little against the common thought process, you're under pressure immediately. And I think it's part of the thing that contributes to uninformed voting and puts us under even more threat that, you know, it's easy to call somebody a liar or change your idea of what you're reporting as news into your opinion. The threat of violence against journalists in America has been in existence since the start of the country. Mm-hmm. Definitely we've seen cases before. But what really I find the threat here is that, you know, reporting the reality puts you at risk of your life, even in America now. It's the whole price that we pay for freedom of the press. But the fact is our journalists need to be protected, not just by word, but in some case, you know, by police action. I mean, it's ridiculous. We have to have lockdowns for some places where we have bomb threats yesterday.
And the bombs being sent to CNN and other media figures. Thanks for that, Jade. I appreciate that so much. A fair point. Joel Simon, what about that? What is the security of folks here on those kinds of grounds?
It's pretty remarkable. I mean, you have to – of course, we had the horrific newsroom shooting at the Capitol Gazette in Maryland earlier this summer that killed five people. And actually, without making a comparison, the three most deadly countries in the world for journalists last year were Afghanistan, Syria, and then United States, which was tied with Mexico as a result of that horrific crime. So we can't think of ourselves as insulated from these global challenges. And of course, we've had newsrooms receiving bomb threats. As we know ourselves, you know, there's a lot of hostility and anger towards the media, and that's being reflected in the way that journalists interact with the people they cover. If you're out covering a demonstration, for example, you're likely to get a lot of abuse. We actually have documented police being more aggressive with journalists who are out there covering demonstrations. So let's not forget that the day-to-day work that journalists are doing, and let's also not think about that work as happening in the White House press briefing room, which is a very rarefied and unusual place, and actually not a lot of news gets made there, as we know. It's journalists, perhaps like the one we just heard from, reporting on his own community. That's the day-to-day work that matters, and those journalists are facing a lot more challenges today.
Well, I was going to say, you monitor this.
Absolutely.
You know, I remember my old boss and mentor, John Carroll, who was my boss.
As well. Yes, wonderful man.
Late John Carroll was my boss in Baltimore. He told me these anecdotes when he oversaw an investigation at the Lexington Herald Leader of the University of Kentucky basketball program, and people shot at the newsroom. You know, it's worse now is what you're saying.
It was in
1982 or
something. Yeah, well, I mean, actually, another great American journalist, Gene Roberts, wrote a book about American journalists covering the civil rights era. And that
Marvelous.
Was that long ago. And the journalists who engaged in that kind of work faced very systematic threats. But I do think that we're seeing an escalation. There's nothing. The Capitol Gazette is an unprecedented act, and the amount of violence, both vitriol, but also threats of violence, is very disconcerting. And the fact also, let's not forget that a lot of the way that journalists interact, I mean, the way that the public who supports Donald Trump interact with journalists who are covering his campaign rallies, is very disturbing. And really sort of legitimates, because the president seems to be cheering them on, that kind of interaction. So that also troubles me a great deal.
So even though in the case of the Capitol Gazette, a place where a former colleague of mine at the Sun, a good friend Rob Hyacin, was among those killed, the fact that was somebody who had a personal grievance did not seem to be ideologically driven. He was upset by coverage that he had received or not received by the paper. You're saying it's part of a larger climate. It's part of a larger culture.
Well, it contributes to whether or not the particular incident is related to the current climate, it contributes to the sense that journalists have that they are vulnerable, that they are under siege, that these violent threats could quickly escalate and become violent acts, that the people they engage with who might use strong and hateful language, that those interactions could escalate and actually become violent. And, you know, if you are a journalist and you are reporting on your own community, the only way you can do that is by engaging directly with the people you cover. If those people are hostile to you and if you feel threatened by them, it limits your ability to do your essential work.
I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. I want to give you just a little taste of how rhetoric gets picked up and used abroad. In January of 2018, after Trump's use of the term fake news to criticize the Times, CNN, God knows how many other news outlets, President Rodrigo Duterte of the Philippines invoked the term to criticize Rappler headed by Maria Ressa, who we heard from a little bit earlier ago. He called Rappler's reporting lies. And then this is what he had to say.
Since you are a fake news outlet, then I am not surprised that your articles are also fake. Now, we can debate now. Tell me where is our lies, and I'll tell you where are yours.
The Philippine authorities are now prosecuting Rappler for tax evasion, I believe, and other charges that many of her advocates and supporters say are clearly trumped up, invented. I'd like to take a call now from Lakeland, Florida. Danny's been waiting patiently. Danny, you have some concerns about the way in which the press goes about its business, I understand.
Yeah, Dave, thanks for taking my call. I try to listen to you every day. I listen to NPR to try and get a balanced approach. I know that NPR leans a little bit left. I'm rather conservative, but I like listening. Go back to, you know, I'm 56 years old, the first 25 years of my life listening to Cronkite as a kid, and then, you know, the big three, NBA, NBC, CBS, ABC, and listen to the nightly news. We had a confidence in those people as we listened to what they reported. When cable news started coming along and things started changing, what happened is that the integrity of the journalism industry just began to go down. I mentioned on the phone earlier that I was a journalism major in college, and I remember hearing the professionalism of how we must have integrity. And what Trump did is he tapped into an underlying thought that we couldn't trust the press. Fox News would not have even made it had there not been that belief in enough of the population to actually buy into it. The left-leaning liberal, whether it was perceived or true, was a real thing. And Fox News made it. And then Fox News went way to the right, and now we can't trust them either. But that's what we have, is we have, similar to our Congress, we have such polarization in the news media that we have nowhere to turn that we can believe that the truth is being told. If 10 facts are discovered in a journalistic investigation and only 8 are presented because the other 2 don't support that person's agenda, that is fake news. That's a lie. It's partial truth.
Danny, I appreciate you bringing this up and framing the issue in that way. Let me throw that to our guest right now. Janine DiGiovanni, how do we claim authority on some of this stuff as we report when, you know, we are mortal, we make mistakes, NPR tries to play it down the middle. Sometimes listeners hear it a different way. But also there are folks who are in it just for clicks and just for ratings and are going to amplify conflict at every turn.
Absolutely. And Danny has such a valid point. I mean, like him, I grew up watching Peter Jennings. And last year, I was the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. So there's some pretty, you know, in American journalism, we have some pretty heady people that we need to follow in their footsteps. I think what is really dangerous right now is the fact that anyone can be a journalist. I mean, Twitter has basically enabled people to say whatever they want, and people reading it feel as though, okay, it's on Twitter, therefore it's factual.
Well, I was going to say, that sounds like a good thing. People can say what they want. It sounds like it's good if people can participate in democratic conversation.
Not when people use Twitter as their news source. And I mean, I have students at Yale that they get their news from reading Twitter or Facebook. I think we've strayed so far from the days of watching, you know, Cronkite and Peter Jennings and reputable journalists deliver news that we took with great authority from their authority. And now people, there are so many TV stations, there's so many battling cable channels and so many battling anchors. And it's, again, what I was saying earlier, it leads to this confusion that I do think Trump has tapped into very deliberately, fear and confusion.
Joel Simon, very briefly, how do we reconcile these competing tensions?
Well, It's very simple. The First Amendment, freedom of expression, freedom of the press, is the enabling environment that allows people to express their ideas freely. But it doesn't guarantee us a responsible press. It doesn't guarantee us that the journalism produced will be the kind of journalism we want. But we need to make sure that we maintain and defend the essential value of freedom of the press. Somehow we're going to work our way through this difficult time period, but we have to maintain those values and principles.
That's Joel Simon, Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. You've also been hearing from Janine DiGiovanni, a war correspondent, author, and senior fellow at Yale. Thanks to you both. We've been talking this hour a bit about the press repression and oppression around the world. think of the quote from George Orwell, the further a society drifts from truth, the more it will hate those that speak it. Thanks for joining us today. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.